everybody. Welcome back to the show. You know where you are, Expert Talk with Tego. And as you know, I love bringing interesting people, fantastic experts, and people that want to make a change. And today, we've got John Tebow here. He's coming in and talking about what it's like to be an executive, what it's like to be an entrepreneur, but he's also going to talk about what it's like to be an advocate for change. Have you been thinking about changing things? Have you been around for the last year or so, looking at everything that's happening, going, there's got to be a better way? Ha, sit right there. We'll be right back. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Tego. I really appreciate being here with you. It's a great to do this with you. Thanks.
I'm so glad to have you here, man. And I know we're going to get to your book. I mean, there's a giant version of it behind you. Is that actual pages or is it just the billboard?
That's just the poster board, right? But I do have the book too, so.
I'm just thinking, you know, when people order that book, it won't fit in the mailbox if it's that big. But we're going to get into that and the fact that you're an author. But you have done a lot of things in a very short amount of time in your lifespan, from music to eBay to being an author. Where do you find all the time, man? What made you decide that now is the time for me to write a book?
Yeah, I think I have an eclectic background, and probably if you're not an accountant, maybe you do. So what I did was I actually did graduate work at UCLA Film School. And so as a teenager, I was involved in a band. And then I said, no, I'm going to switch to film. I switched to film, went to UCLA, and then switched from production and then got into writing. And so I wrote a lot of screenplays. And then after that, I had friends who said, well, you should write a novel. So I wrote a couple of novels. And then fast forward a few years, and I ended up working at one of the major studios, MCA Universal at the time, and ended up in government affairs. And my agent at the time said, wow, that's really interesting, because we were dealing with congressmen and senators and heads of state. And I thought, wow, this is just so unusual because people don't know about it. And I was fascinated. Right. And I thought, well, I'll just write in the evenings or on weekends and continue with this. But what happened was I kind of got this bug where I began to understand how laws are made and how people in government affairs and big companies work with the administration and the senators and the congressmen. And it's from that that I said, and I put that in the back of my mind. Fast forward a few years, I ended up on the early team at eBay as VP of marketing, and then did the same thing at another company called Financial Engines. And then after that, I said, you know, this political thing is still kind of interesting. So I came back to this idea saying, you know, so many of us don't really know how to do it. So many people are frustrated. And then from that, I wrote a series of a couple of different books, but one of them is How to Change a Law.
Okay, but you're a creative, you know, I'm a creative. Yeah. And we tend to run away from grown-up stuff like government affairs and politics and changing laws. Man, we're the ones outside playing, you know, when all that stuff is going on. We're creating the next great whatever is coming down the road. What made you just go, wait a minute, I can do this. This is important. And stop. Did you stop being creative, or did you find a way to incorporate that creative side into your government affairs side of your body?
Yeah, when I was there, I wasn't thinking about it. I was doing what you just described. I was working with attorneys and lobbyists and, you know, business folks and CEOs of companies and all that. And so I wasn't thinking, what can I do to change it? I was just, through osmosis, absorbing how they did it. And really, it was years later that I came back and said, you know, there should be a simpler, more fun way. And maybe eBay had something to do with this too, because eBay was really merging buyers and sellers on a common platform to make it right. really equitable and easy for people to be able to trade anywhere in the world. And I said, what if you could do the same thing in politics, right? Get rid of the friction between the voter and the politician, make it simple, hide all the complexity. And so people aren't like all, you know, as they are now, sometimes freaked out because, you know, lobbyists are bad, politicians are corrupt, et cetera. And mm-hmm. that's, you know, we can talk a little bit about that, but I mean, it's like, it comes down to, we want to have a say, but we have to find a better way of doing it. And that's really what drove me.
Okay, you said a little word that has a lot of power. eBay. And you didn't just say it because you're a guy that goes through and does yard sales every quarter or so in your house. You have a true connection to eBay, correct?
I did and do. Yeah.
What was your connection to eBay?
Well, my wife and I, at the time, my wife and I were living in Boulder, Colorado. I had started a small software company. The internet came along in 95 and I said, there's something going on. So I started interviewing with companies back here in the Bay. I'm in the Bay Area, and ran across this little company called AuctionWeb. And I met with them, and there was only, you know, three other executives there, two or three other executives, and a staff of seven, right? And they were doing auctions. And I remember, I joke about this, my wife said to me, auctions? What do you know about auctions? And I said, nothing. That's why it's so perfect. And so I came in actually as the first vice president of business development, and then took over marketing when there was only seven of us there. And we were trying to figure out, how do we make this work? You know, dealing with customers, how to deal with, you know, shipping goods and services. How do you get people to trust the platform?
Right.
So I was there when there was like 10 people.
Wait a minute. So the company that you were working with, where there were only 10 people, became the eBay that we know today?
Yeah, we rebranded it. It was called AuctionWeb. And what happened is Pierre Omidyar, who's the founder, he had a corporate entity called eBay. It was based on like East Bay or something. And we thought that AuctionWeb was too generic because there was all kinds of auction companies at the time, small auction companies that were coming up. And we said, you know, the interesting thing with eBay is nobody knows what it means. So we could brand it to be anything. And that's kind of how that happened. So we switched the name, and I was heading up the team that brought in, back then we had all these little color characters and the Beanie Babies and all that kind of stuff. So I was the person who was overseeing the introduction of those things. I mean, the other VPs were, you know, the CEO of the company, a president who handled admin, and then the VP of engineering and myself.
I'm sitting here going, he's a Beanie Baby specialist. Yeah. That's what just played in my head. You know, when companies get as big as like eBay or Amazon or Facebook, you don't think about the people behind it, that it had to be a startup somewhere. It didn't just appear on the planet one day and there's millions of transactions happening every day and millions of people associated with it like it is today in right. 2021. I've been in internet marketing. I've been in production for, you know, the last 20 plus years of my life. I never thought about, well, who started eBay? Where did it come from? You hear the stories about Microsoft, you hear the stories about Apple, and you just take it for granted that eBay just appeared. And to hear that story really as an entrepreneur gives me hope. Because it's going, everybody had to start somewhere, yeah. You know? How yeah. did you guys face the fear? I mean, you're talking about creating something at that time nobody was doing.
Right.
Auctions, right. All of that. Nobody was doing that on the internet. How did you face that fear and say, you know, we're going to stick it out through the rough times. This is going to work.
Yeah, it's funny. We started actually around the same time as Amazon in 1995. And I knew friends who, some of them left eBay and went to Amazon and then came back. So there's this back and forth. But it was actually started Labor Day 1995 by Pierre Omidyar. And he was in Campbell, California. And he had the idea that maybe he could sell something. And I think there's a couple of different stories, but one is that he had a laser pointer, a broken laser pointer, put it on the internet and wanted to see if somebody would buy it. Well, someone bought it, I think, for $7, and it didn't even work, apparently. And from that, it was, let's solve one problem after another. And again, very similar to the Jeff Bezos story. You know, I watched his early or read the early book that he did. And he talks about just, you know, he put the thing up, started selling some books, and then one day somebody bought it and there was a little bit of revenue coming in. So it was the same thing with us. And what ended up happening was people, like you said, they became empowered because they said, oh my God, I can go to the internet and I'm not buying things. I can actually be a seller. So we spent a lot of time thinking about who's more important, the buyer or the seller, what's the ratio, how can we serve both sides? And we understood it was a two-sided market between them. And it was like, well, what can we do to make it easier? And so building the community was a big part of that.
So as someone who has had such a like eclectic, diverse, whatever kind of words you want to put together about your career, you know, you've been with Beanie Babies and vice presidents of major industry. That is a widespread that most people would never think, no, that doesn't go together. That would never happen. Which was first for you? Were you in eBay and then went to film school? Had you already gone to film school and worked at Universal? How did that work? Which way did your path turn?
Yeah, the trajectory really was, as I said, high school music, then film and television. I was very interested in it. I got in, I did undergraduate in Toronto and then did graduate school at UCLA in the film school. I spent summers actually on some production crews doing commercials and those kinds of things and interning. And then I switched and said, you know what, you know, if you want to, I mean, I think everybody at UCLA at the time in the film school wanted to be a director. And they said, the way you become a director is what Martin Scorsese or some of these other guys had done, and you write a screenplay. So a lot of my friends were writing screenplays. The demand within the department was that you had to write one within, I guess it was, we had a quarter system. So you had to do it like within 60 days, which was pretty fast. Just get it done. So I ended up writing, as it turned out, about 21 screenplays over 7 or 8 years. And then spent time in Hollywood trying to get projects mounted. You know, we're talking about kind of sort of bumping around famous people, but there was one time where I was spending time with the early creators of Alien and Total Recall as well, Ron Chousette. And so did two projects with him. And again, they never got off the ground. They were either too expensive or too advanced in it from a science fiction standpoint. So fast forward with the film thing. And again, unlike Silicon Valley, the attrition rate is very high in Hollywood. It was very hard, very frustrating. I'm getting married and thinking, I can't keep doing this. So, quote, get a real job. I ended up at the studios and this assignment came up where they said we had this thing in government affairs, which again, I knew nothing about, and told my wife, well, they want someone to be sort of a liaison. And this is when actually Bill Clinton was coming into office. So early 93.
From 93 to 96.
And so we hosted him because Lou Wasserman, who has now passed, was the chairman, but he would corral, he would build coalitions of all the studio heads, you know, Paramount, Fox, Katzenberg, Michael Eisner, on and on and on, and bring them all together and say, look, we want to get something done politically. And he had done this for years for every administration going back to the Kennedy administration. So I was surrounded by these people all the time, right? And we were a very small staff, and it was fascinating because you just got to, you know, you got to meet these people on a personal level. And what I realized too was that the politicians were as flattered and amazed by Hollywood as Hollywood was enamored of the politicians.
Exactly.
So we had the advantage of saying, hey, bring your family, let's go to the Beverly Hills Hotel and have drinks, or let's do a private dinner on the lot, or we could do the Universal Studios private tour, which we would do. So politicians would come in, some who are still in office actually, and they would say, oh, I wanna do a private tour. And so we would take them through that, and they would get all the behind the scenes stuff, right? The VIP treatment. So it was a mix of things, you know? And from that, it actually, the one thing that, I don't want to ramble too much, but the one thing that got me out of that was there was a shooting late April of 1993 on the MCA Black Tower in North Hollywood. And so we literally had a sniper attack, and I had bullets flying through the office, hitting the walls, got down on my hands and knees and I'm crawling to get out of there. And it seemed like, I mean, you've heard of these different shootings at places all the time, mm-hmm. But it seemed like there were three shooters. They were triangulating on the building. And then there was like helicopters above us. It was like really scary because I thought, oh my God, wow. I'm gonna die. And it was, you know, this is the violence of LA. We lived through Rodney King. We lived through the riots. We lived through, you know, the shooting at the tower. I mean, all that. And so my wife and I just said, we got to get out of here. So wow. we left. I left after 3 years, moved to Boulder, Colorado, and started this little software company. Now here's a flip. Oddly, I was focusing on creating violence-free software, thinking that would work. But it didn't get picked up. And then it was on, you know, the old multimedia CD-ROM stuff like that, yep. DVD and all that. So yep. That went away really fast. And then I came back to the whole idea of we got to get back into town, basically either LA or San Francisco. And I started interviewing with companies in the internet space. And that's how I got into eBay.
You know, I'm going to shift gears for just a second because I think you can answer this question pretty easy. You know, today, everybody is not reading for the most part. We've gotten super lazy. They say our attention span is shorter than a goldfish right now. Yeah. And, you know, as a small business, as a business of any size, in your opinion, how important is video? How important is what we're doing right now to grow a business?
I hear what you hear, that, you know, people aren't reading or they're not reading long form as much. And I think video is important if it's done right. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is video and or audio, while, you know, it gives you the opportunity to listen to it in the car or to watch it when you perhaps you're doing something else or to do it when you will, which I think mm-hmm. has really helped the streaming services like Netflix and Prime and all those. I mean, mm-hmm. you don't have to wait for the show to come on. You pick what you want, when you want. And so it's a la carte, right? Mm-hmm. But there's still a place for books. And my understanding is that reading is still going on. A lot of sort of the older generation, baby boomers and above, still like physical books because they want to mark them up. But I actually really, when the Kindle first came out or any of the early digital books, I liked it because you could be on the beach and just say, I feel like reading this, boom, download it, and you would have the book. Right. So I like the ability to do both. And I think it's, you know, if you're an information junkie, then you're going to do both anyway. And my kids, by the way, you talk about short attention spans. They're teenagers and they maybe watch YouTube a little bit, but they're on TikTok, right? I asked my daughter who's 16, I said, how long is TikTok? And she said, they're 60 seconds. All these little crazy movies where they put all kinds of stuff in and they're 60 seconds long. And she said she has friends who she knows who they have followers, like 20 million followers in 6 months.
Yeah.
I'm like, wow, how do you do that?
Yeah. And now YouTube has their version of TikTok. They're doing 60-second vertical video. Instagram is doing Instagram Reels, which are 60 seconds. They say up to 2 minutes vertical video. So yeah, it's getting really, really popular. But I still think that baby boomers prefer to have something in their hand that's a book, and they prefer longer content than 60 seconds because I just don't see me sitting there flipping next. That's not me, you know, but I watch my grandson who's 14. He could sit there all night, just ha ha ha, next, ha ha, next. And his attention span is like a nanosecond. You know, he doesn't even want to talk about dinner. He's like, what? No, that's okay. Thank you.
Yeah,
you
know? I think that's a disadvantage too, though. You know, if your attention span is so short, then you don't have the power of concentration. Again, mm-hmm. if I go back to when I was writing pretty seriously every day, I would actually close my door, tell my roommates at the time, I'd put a sign up and say, do not disturb, and turn, maybe have classical music on or something. But I literally could then focus, I mean, really with a lot of attention for like 6 hours at a time. And if you're undisturbed with no calls, nothing else going on, you can really get into your head and you can really think through a lot of material very quickly. Mm-hmm. So I could see the entire book in my head in a 6 hour period, or I could understand the character's life. Or in the case of this book, it's the same thing. I can think about what all the chapters are, how it's going to be laid out, and kind of mentally process it, you know? But if I had a very short attention span, I couldn't do that.
Yeah, exactly. I totally agree with you. You know, I still love just kind of getting away from all of the noise, all of the craziness, and concentrating on what it is we're doing right now. Because, you know, I always tell everybody success is in the details. And to me, you can't get to the details if you can't concentrate past 5 seconds of your time. You're looking for instant gratification. And it's like when you're building something like writing a book or building a business, it's not instant. It's not Kool-Aid. You don't put it in there, add some water and stir. You got to work for that, you know, and that's a great segue for me because I kind of teased at the top of the show that we were going to talk about change. And a lot of people want to make change and they think you can't, you know, make laws change. You can't help get a law be created. I remember when I was a kid, there was this, you know, after school thing, and the little cartoon said, "I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill, and I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill." That's all we knew about how laws were made was a little guy sitting at Capitol Hill. You know, we never thought we could do that. And you're telling me that you can affect change. You can change laws, have new laws created. Right?
Yep, that's the idea.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So look, I know I'm gonna get there. Just give me a second. We got to go to a break. So we're gonna take a quick break. And when we come back, we're gonna get into how do you change a law? How do you become an advocate for change? And how do you go from talking about it to making it happen? So sit right there. We'll be right back. I hear you. I hear you. It's time for us to talk about exactly what I said at the top of the show. How do you make change? And I'm not talking about change for a dollar. I'm talking about making change in this country. And I've got the right guy. Hey, John. Okay, let's talk about it. Where did this book come from? And is it real? Can you really change a law?
Great questions. So the book is based primarily on my experience having worked in government affairs at MCA Universal, years ago. And what I did was say, and I thought, well, wouldn't it be great if I could share this idea with more people? And when I talked about it, they were fascinated. And then I'd have these hour-long conversations. And after a while, I said, well, I should just write a book to make it, here's the book. Just have a nice day. So I wrote the book, How to Change a Law, and then put it out there and revised it and did all that, and then looked to see if there were some other stories. And as time went on, I discovered there were some other people who were doing similar kinds of things. But the idea really comes down to, what you referred to. Can we average voters actually change a law or propose a law or a bill? And you can. I mean, the way it works now is the lawmakers do it. Okay, so the politicians are the ones who do it. They come up with the ideas, and we think, well, the only people they listen to are special interests, corporations, trade associations, et cetera. But the rest of us are sitting here going, how come they're not listening to me? And you hear the same thing over and over again, like, we don't have a voice. They won't listen to me. They don't return my calls. On the other hand, they have, like at the congressional level, they have very small staff. They may only have three or four staff people. And they get like 10,000 emails a month. So for them, they need to automate that process. They can't look at every single one and say, oh, here's a great idea, here's a great idea. They just don't have the means to do that. So the people who get through are the ones who have the relationships and know them. And we hear all this stuff about like, well, they gave them money, therefore they're donors and all that. And you can ask me, did that happen when we were in the entertainment industry? And the answer is yes. It happens because there's rules about how to do it. It's not corruption, which I kind of, people talk about that, but it's like, forget that. It's a waste of time. The real idea is that if you have an idea, and your idea is better than the politicians, then I think it behooves us to become involved. And there are activists who've done it. Mothers Against Drunk Driving is a great example, but that took her a really long time. Okay. And she took it because there was, you know, this problem in her life, of course, where her child was killed by a drunk driver. And that was back in the 80s. So she did it the long, hard way out of passion and focus and diligence over time. And she actually got laws changed at the state and federal level. Huge, huge case. And that affects us today in terms of, you know, the blood alcohol content, you know, when we're driving.
Definitely.
A more recent example is a senator here in California, in the district that I'm in, Senator Joe Simidian. He, when he was in office, he actually solicited opinions from constituents. So there's a million people in the district. He would say, hey, if you have an idea and you want to bring it up, let me know. So probably hundreds of people each year would submit it on their calendar. Mm-hmm. He would review those with him and his staff and then say, okay, we're going to pick these 5 or 10. I think these are really good ideas. And I've talked to him and he said, you know, the ideas that came out of that, that we got laws done and bills done, were ideas that we, the politicians, never would have thought of ourselves. And so that's really, I think, an encouraging sign that someone is open and willing to do that. The only thing there is it's only his district, right? And so you got 50 other states and it could be 50 to 100 other senators and representatives in all those states, but they're not doing it. So it's hard to get through. That's really a big part of it. And so I look at the problem and I said, you know, what if there was a way to simplify it? So it's not Twitter, it's not Facebook where you're just shouting all over the place. You're in a very formalized kind of environment or a platform, and you can say, here's my idea and here's how I want to go forward. And that's kind of what we've done with the platform.
So, but okay, give me a couple of things. Give me like 3 things that people can do so they can get their voices heard, because usually you're just talking to your best friend, your cousin, or on social media, like you said, shouting from the top of your soapbox and nobody's really listening. If they're serious, you know, like Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, and they know they need to have this happen because of whatever reason it is, what are a couple of things they can do to be able to get heard?
Yeah, so I'm gonna do kind of a high level. And the 3 things, I've broken them down because I think they apply whether or not you are doing a petition, a protest, calling into talk radio, writing an editorial to the Wall Street Journal, any of those things. You're doing 3 things. And the first one is you need to clarify your issue, you know? What that means is get really clear about what you want. There's only 2 things you're going to do. You're going to either advocate for something or try to get something to stop from happening. You know, it's sort of like save the whales versus I want to do something with electrical energy or save the environment or whatever. So you need to get clear on what that piece is. And there's a lot of little pieces that fall in under that. But clarify your issue. The second thing is you need to build a coalition. And again, if I look at MCA, that's exactly what we did. We brought all the studio heads together and we brought all the people together. That's what trade associations do. They build a coalition of people who agree with them, maybe some who even disagree. But the idea of having dissent to me is important. And I know a lot of people say, no, no, we don't want to hear the other side. I actually think we need to hear the other side, because what happens, they are going to buffer our idea. If we were all geniuses and brilliant, we would have the solution to the problem. So you clarify your issue, you need to build a coalition of people who are going to support you and then sharpen the debate. And then the final thing is that you need to appeal to a higher authority, okay? And what we do is we kind of fall down in either one of those areas because we don't do that. And when I say appeal to a higher authority, if you think about it, if you have a problem with you know, taxes or something, then you get an accountant. If you have a problem with some legal issue, you hire an attorney. If you have a problem in the political spectrum, who do you go to? Well, maybe you go to your representative. You could do that. Or you can go to a government affairs consulting group. You could do that. Or you can go to a lobbyist, which is what all the major corporations do. Sometimes they say, oh, we agree, we don't like lobbyists. But you probably realize that all of the Fortune 500, they all have lobbying firms, they all have government affairs firms. They're doing this all the time, the same way they would have attorneys or they would have accountants. So for us as individuals, what you would do is you'd say, look, I'm going to appeal to a higher authority. And in that case, it may in fact be your representative in your district. But I alluded to this earlier when we talked, the wonky part of it is, you also need to know who the other members of the committee are, because it isn't one person on the committee just saying, oh, I'm going to pass this because I believe in it. And again, I'm using the federal, the congressional level as a sample, but there's usually 20 to 25 people on a committee, okay? Mm-hmm. So whatever one it is, and they are all sitting in different districts, but I can't talk to them because I'm in my district. I'm in a silo, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea is, how am I gonna find my grandmother or my aunt or someone who lives in Wyoming 1 or Florida 2 or California 17, all these other districts, to right. help me move it forward? And the only way I can do that is if they self-identify, build this coalition with me, agree on the idea, and then we all simultaneously appeal to that person.
So in your book, I mean, I'm sitting here going, I never knew this stuff. And just knowing you, I'm going, there's so much stuff we could do. In your book, you give 50 reasons why, you know, yeah. you know, 50, not 5, not 20, you know, so people are going, oh, there's no reason to do this. And you're like, ah, here's 50 reasons why. What made you decide to shoot for 50? And I bet you could have shot for 100, correct?
Probably. I just looked at broad categories and thought, why do people do it now? And I think they do it. I mean, sometimes you do it because you're altruistic, okay? You are saying, I want to help children. And I really am. We all have a certain passion about an issue. And we usually have 2 or 3, right? Mm-hmm. So if you say, I really care about children's rights and the whole trafficking thing, and I find this, it's just incredibly offensive to me, you know, just mm-hmm. horribly offensive. And if you were saying, look, I really want to do something in that area, then you're going to be passionate and driven and want to do it. So that's an altruistic way of approaching it. You know, you're helping somebody else, you know, mm-hmm. where you have the advantage, you have the ability, and you can give back. The other side is where you're saying, hey, I want to do it for me or my company or whatever. I want to get a $200 million carve out by getting my company included in Section 203A or whatever it might be in some amendment, because we're going to get a big tax rebate. So I mm-hmm. help my senator or congressman write a bill where I get a little piece, and only the companies that fall into that category, which is just me and my company, right? Mm-hmm. I get $200 million. And nobody knows, because it's buried in the bill. And we see good that grief. All the time in these very complex bills. Wow. So I think the reasons people do it are economic. You know, they're going to gain an advantage for themselves economically, et cetera. Or they're doing it because they're saying there is some harm that we want to change. Like when we've had, you know, dirty water, dirty air, those kinds of things, people said, you know, we got to clean up the lakes. We got to do this, save the environment, you know, save the wolves. I mean, I talked to a lobbyist probably a little while back, and he said, I don't care what idea. I thought it was interesting. He said, I don't care what idea you have, like anything you could think of. He said, I guarantee you there's a bill sitting in the legislature related to that right
wow.
now.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. So it isn't as though they're doing it, but you know, they're there.
Wow. Okay. So that brings up another question. You're fired up. You're ready to go. It's like, I know this is what needs to happen. I'm advocating for this or that. And then what are some of the mistakes people make when they run out the gate, you know, and they're ready to do this? What are a couple of the mistakes people make?
Yeah, I think some of them are these early on mistakes that everybody is doing. And even the politicians do it. They complain and they blame. Right? You can't listen to television and the left is saying the right is bad. The right is saying the left is bad. Mm-hmm. And then they're saying, I'm fine. I'm perfect. I did everything right. And he or she, they screwed up. They're to blame. And mm-hmm. somehow everybody else picks up on that. And then we all do this division, you know, what party are you in? What party are you not in? I'm trying to, as much as possible, stay off the party line and go with issues only. So staying issue focused. Because if I ask you and said, is education an issue on the left or right? Well, probably neither, right? Or is healthcare a Democrat or Republican issue? Probably neither. I mean, mm-hmm. what we're talking about is how do you solve real problems? And I mm-hmm. think the idea of bringing people and having them come together is the answer to that. So just to come back to your question about what people do as a mistake is, yes, they complain, they blame, they have fuzzy thinking in terms of immediately getting into ad hominem attacks, you know, oh, you know, I'll use simple examples so I'm not offending anybody. His tie is, I hate the color of his tie, or his wife was, you know, took some money on some campaign. That's terrible. You know what I mean? It's all that other stuff. It has nothing to do with the issue. It's just like ad hominem attacks of the individual. So there's a handful of those things. It's like, you know, fuzzy thinking, talking to the wrong person is another one. Like you said, people will talk to their neighbor, their dog, their friend, their wife. But ultimately, and as they're venting, it's hilarious. As they're venting all this, they really should be talking to the politician. But he doesn't want to hear them complain, or she. He wants to say, what's your solution? Come to me with your ideas, please. You know, be constructive. And that's really a big part of it. And then the other thing we do is, you know, we focus on celebrity candidates. We say, oh my, and that's what I said about, you know, ad hominem attacks. You know, oh, he's so charming. I mean, I see this now. This person is so charming, and I could name, you know, a bunch of politicians who, and they're all very, you know, charismatic.
Yep, I know a few too.
Nice. I mean, I believe everything they say. It just seems like, wow, they're really great. So I'm voting for them, and I'm voting for them, but I don't even know what any of their issues are. I don't know what their voting record is. I don't know what their bills are. I don't know any of that kind of stuff. So,
but he's cute.
Yeah, they're cute. They look like me, so I'm voting for them. And again, these are things that we all do. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think it just, that's a natural instinct. But at the same time, if you want to say, I want to, like, if you don't want to be an armchair activist and just, because that's sort of fun, that's like a backseat driver.
Or armchair quarterback.
Why don't you do this? Why don't they do that? You know, people talking to their television sets, right? Why don't they do this? You have to come back to the point of being focused and intentful about the thing that you want to get done. You probably can't do 20 things, but if you had one or two issues that you said, I really think this is important, I'd like to get it. And I think at the federal level, it's very hard. So if you pull it down and say, just focus on your community, focus on your homeowners association, try to get something small done, put a street sign up on your street so kids aren't run over by cars, put speed bumps up. And you learn that lesson at a very local, simple level. Little by little, you're going to become across as a rational person and your ideas will get implemented.
You know, I know there's a few people out there that are watching this and they're going, he's talking to me. He's talking to me. So how do they find your book? Where do they go to find your book?
Yeah, so the book is called How to Change a Law. And it's on every possible place. Amazon, it's available. Actually, it's available Audible, softcover, Kindle, and all the other typical distribution channels. As well. And so it's on, the book is on Amazon. The platform is called ilobby.co, but there's a little learning curve there. So the book actually is the stepping stone to get you to that point. And there's a site which is more educational where we have videos and some other things, and that's called changealaw.com.
Okay. Okay. So changealaw.com, that's where you can get videos and kind of get an introductory lesson, correct?
Yeah.
So I wanted to, before I let you get out of here, I know you're a busy, busy guy. We definitely got to talk about ilobby.co. I mean, that's the next level. You know, when you go there, I went through the website and you actually have people that are taking action. You know, they're stepping out. What made you be the founder of this particular website? And what is your hope and for the purpose of it coming years down the road?
Yeah, I, you know, people have either entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley have a big vision or a little vision. I love the idea of saying, could we change democracy around the world? You know, it was like, wow, how would we do that? And so it was the same kind of idea that we talked about with eBay. Could we take small steps and then implement on a platform, a common platform, the steps that people might need to take to be able to begin to build a debate, to get a bill together, etc. And so it's structured in such a way that you could write up 200 or 300 words, you could show both sides. So basically you're showing your issue, your position, you know, are you on left or right? The issue that you want, the arguments that are there, facts that support it, and you can include links to videos or other supporting material. And then a conclusion saying, huh, I have the answer to global hunger. Here it is. And we should have a law that does X, right? You put it up, and then you need to share like crazy. And that's really the key. People need to share it on all the social media channels and say, hey, could you help me do this? Because what we're trying to do there is you need to have people from these other districts get into it as well. Because if I, like I said, if I go to my congressperson and say, I want this done, and if she doesn't sit on agriculture, she might say, oh, you got to talk to the guy in Texas. And if I call him and say, hi, I'm in California, can you help me? The first thing he'll ask me is, or his staff will ask me is, where do you live? I'm going to tell him I live in California. He'll say, I'm sorry, I can't talk to you. You got to talk right to your person. Now I have this catch 22. I'm like, oh, and I can't get anything done, right? I'm stuck. The way people get around that, the way corporations get around it, is they hire a lobbying firm who can access anybody across the board, right? That's how that works. For individuals, it's a little bit of the same thing. Ultimately, and here's an example I've used, and a lot of people are like, man, I don't know about that. But I said that if you had 20,000 people who agreed on one issue, instead of going to a movie or whatever it is, and you put $50 in on a single issue, you would have raised $1 million. And if that group had raised $1 million, kind of like we have with Kickstarter or something,
right,
$1 million, you could hire any lobbying firm in Washington tomorrow. Now,
wow.
You move that down to a smaller scale and say at the state level, you probably don't need it. At the local level, you probably don't need it as well. But the idea is have a diversity of people who come together and they don't shout each other down. They don't get weird and all that. They just say, hey, let's solve the problem. You know, let's figure out how to get this done. That's the idea behind it. And I think, you know, this is what the top 1% are doing. They're doing it all the time, you know? And so All I'm saying is, it would be great if more people picked up on it and said, ah, I get it, that's how I do it. And I mean, and some people want to, some people don't, but it is a little bit of an intellectual pursuit.
You know, I wouldn't be doing my job if I let you get out of here without asking this next question. And I'm gonna make it my last question of the day because I'm gonna bug you to come back on. This is really fascinating for me and I know a lot of other people, but you are a visionary. You've been, you know, doing this thing called creating in one environment or another since you were a child. So what's next for John? What's on the horizon? What do you see in front of you?
Well, you know, I've been doing this for a while, okay? It's like eBay was a rocket. We lit it and it took off. This is like a C-130. It's just like, really slowly, just like, you know, on a hot day in Arizona or something. So one of the things I think is really interesting is with artificial intelligence and the whole idea of being able to write things. We know that AI and GPT-3 and some of these things now can write statements for us. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, one of the difficulties people have is expressing themselves. So if there was a way to just say, hey, look, my idea is I want to save the whales and I want to do this and I want to do that. And I only have 3 or 4 sentences. Then I could put it through an AI engine, you know, machine learning and artificial intelligence. And then it comes back and it writes up this bill, right? Which is sort of the beginning of model legislation. And then that becomes the basis for this grouping that we want to get done. Right?
I love it.
Then all of a sudden, you really have people who are empowered and who could actually make change. And the idea that this would work in, the way I viewed it was, it would work in every democratic country around the world. And what I found is when I've talked to people from Eastern Europe, some of who are on the site, they come back and say, oh, because they really appreciate democracy, right? Because they didn't have it, you know, for many, many years under the old regimes. So they come into this and they go, oh my God, you can really talk, you can say what you want, you know? And I think it's important that we don't lose that.
That's amazing. Okay, yeah. See, I knew it. I knew you have to come back. I knew there was more. I'm so excited. I wanna thank you, sir. Please tell them one more time the 3 websites that they can go to or the 3 sources they can go to before I let you get out of here.
Yeah, you can go to changealaw.com. And the book is available on Amazon and every other platform and bookstores, et cetera. Libraries can actually, a library ordered 300 copies or 500 copies distributed back in New York just recently. So wow. I was very excited by that, to distribute it to schools and to government agencies. And I was like, great, let's do it. So that's the book, and it's available pretty much everywhere. It's How to Change the Law. And the site itself, the platform, is www.ilobby.co. It's not .com. .com takes you somewhere else. So it's ilobby.co.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for being on the show and hanging out with us and just sharing a little bit, because I know it's a humongous process, but someone, you, took the time to show regular people like me that it can be done. And you're not just a bill. Yes, you're only a bill sitting on the Capitol Hill. You can actually make change. And I want to thank you so much for coming.
Good. Thank you so much.
Hey, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that episode. Yeah, we're talking about change, and you guys are sitting here talking about this has to change and that has to change and so-and-so needs to do it. Hi, you're so-and-so, in case you didn't know. And people like John is showing you how you can make the change. I hope you enjoyed the episode. I hope you'll come back next week. You know I totally appreciate you. And as always, I'm Tego, and I'll talk to you next time.